I mean, the list is endless. At some point, he was training just about any grandmaster in Indian chess who was at the brink of, let's say, an IM title or something, would go to Chennai, stay with him, learn from him.
How many people do you have working for you right now?
Now we have 30 people whom we pay a salary.
You've recently done an interview with Kramnik at the Olympiad also, and that kind of shocked me. What is your relationship with Kramnik, and what did you take away from that interview?
I think Vladimir Kramnik is someone.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the C-Squared Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest. It's International Master Sagar Shah. Hopefully, I pronounced that correctly. Sagar, first of all, you are just an inspiration with everything you have achieved for the last quite a few years by now. It wasn't always easy, but it felt like you came along at the right time with the right initiatives and an incredible passion for the game, but a passion also for building up a community. And you've done just that with Chess Base India, just an incredible effort, you and Amruta as well. And I want to firstly start with your beginnings. You are also an international master, so obviously you've had quite an illustrious career as a chess player as well. But at some point you realized that you want to do something different, and you carved out this path for you. Tell us how Chess Base India started.
Yeah, thank you, Christian, for this introduction. Also, hi, Fabi, and thanks, guys, for having me on the podcast. I think I started chess when I was around 10 years old, not so young. My father taught me, and I was perhaps not that quick in growing up during chess, which is why I read a lot of books at that phase. And I didn't have a very permanent trainer or something of that sort when growing up. So books really helped me back then. I was not improving quickly, but I believe it helped me in the phase when I started commentating or writing about chess. That was very useful. And I think my life's phase can be divided into the parts where I began playing chess, which was in 2000. I kept improving until 2008. I was around 2200 or so. Then I met Amruta in one of the tournaments. She was also playing there. And then we started our relationship. And I think chess became such an integral part of my life that even though I finished Chartered Accountancy, which is like a pretty decent degree in India, I never had the doubt that I would continue doing chess. So in 2014, Amruta and I got married. I was still roughly around 2300 rated. And then we went to Spain in that year, and I finished my GM title. Sorry, IM title. GM title still remains a dream. I finished my IM title. I reached 2468. Won a decent tournament called Dresden Open. Made my first GM nom. Also finished my second GM nom next year. So everything was heading towards sort of becoming a GM. Maybe I was training a bit some players in India, had these coaching related things going on. But I think I really enjoyed writing, and I used to submit some of my articles to Chessbase. Frederick Friedel, who got my first article, which was on my marriage, saw some potential in me and started helping me get better. This was also around 2014. So a lot of things happened there. I got married. I started writing for Chessbase. I was also improving at chess. But it was clear to me that somehow my passion was in writing about chess, creating content. Back then, not so much video, but more written stuff. I used to go to tournaments and write as well as play. So I remember Qatar Open, where I played in 2015, which was a very strong event. And I faced all 2,600 GMs there. And I would play the game, come back to the room, write a huge report on Chessbase. And that would take 5 to 6 hours. And this started becoming very difficult to sustain both these things, which is why at some point we had to make this switch. And by that time, Chessbase India had begun, because in India, there was not that much coverage about chess. The newspapers didn't have the space to cover chess as a sport, because cricket is very, very popular here. And we thought that there are many, many things happening in chess which need coverage. So that's how we started with a Facebook page called Chessbase India. And this is how it began. And this was 2015, late 2015 and so on. And then things rolled on.
But what was the vision at that point? Because obviously right now, everybody knows the powerhouse that India became. But in 2014, 2015, sure, you had Vishy, of course, a mentor for the young generation. You had Hare Krishna, I think it was perhaps the second best rated player in the country. But you didn't have as many strong players. Perhaps you could count the GMs on both of your hands. Right now, you guys have more than 100 grandmasters. And that only happened in the last decade or so. What was the vision when you first started Chessbase India?
Yeah, I think one of the things which Amruta always said is that, you know, we would play tournaments and there was no one to take any pictures or anything. So it came more from a personal thing that there is something lacking. And then we realized that there is news everywhere. For example, I remember 2015 World Cup, the highest performing Indian was Sethuraman, who reached round 3 by, I think he beat Mamedyarov. Back then.
Did he beat Anish as well? Was it
2017.
2017,
he was very,
yes,
very close to beating him, but then Anish did beat him. And these were the news back then, like, you know, Vidit crossing 2700 in 2017. He was the youngest ever Indian to do so. Hare Krishna, who actually equaled Vishy Anand's surpassed Vishy Anand on live rating for that one day when Anand was playing in the candidates 2016, lost, and Hare Krishna did well somewhere. So he was 2770 back then. So all these news were like there. We traveled to Moscow for Vishy playing in the candidates. At that point, a lot of news did revolve around Vishy because he was the only player playing in super tournaments per se. But, you know, we always had this interest in identifying talents. So in 2014 World Juniors, which was at that point won by Lu Shanglai, Wei Yi was there, Vladimir Fedosiev, it was in India. A little Nihal Sarin was playing there and a little Prag was playing, and we interviewed them back then. They were 9 and 10 years old. And I think this started to sort of become very interesting for people, this youngest grandmaster record. Back then, it caught the fancy when Prag was actually growing. Everyone was like, okay, will Prag break Karjakin's record and so on. And newspapers started picking it up from what we were covering. So I believe that at first, Prag and Nihal were two youngsters whom everyone wanted to follow. And perhaps with their growth, along with the other talents as well, Chessbase India started to grow. And also, India did not have these softwares of Chessbase available or the books that are needed. So there was piracy here. You could see that people were purchasing books which were Xeroxed or softwares which were burnt on disks and so on. And I thought maybe it's possible to have something which is cheaper than what exists there, because clearly the spending capacity of Indians wasn't that high. Which is why, everything that we've done, either with chess-based products or with books and so on, we have this concept of PPP, or the purchasing power parity, where you cannot have the same prices in India that exist in Europe or USA So that was also one way to set up the business where we didn't have to have any investors or something because of the goodwill that was created by ChessBase and the product that was needed. We started having some income and we could build our team.
Yeah, that's very cool. And that was sort of my next question, because I did not know the story of the name itself, ChessBase India, and the partnership. Obviously, everybody knows ChessBase and what ChessBase stands for, but they stand for the brand of software that all the chess players are using. Now, ChessBase India, it almost became its own brand. Do you guys still have any sort of connection with them, or are you sort of separated at this point?
Yeah, I mean, we always started with our own company, which was incorporated in India. But ChessBase was amazing to trust us, because when we began, they were like, okay, you can use our name, you can set up whatever you want. And every time you sell a product, the X percent would go to them. So this agreeing to a different price for India and its surrounding countries like Bangladesh or, you know, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and also giving us the right to sell there, but just letting us do what we wanted to, because the vision always was to sort of grow Indian chess, to grow the chess in the country. So we started off with several things, but as and when the needs arose, is when we build that. So just to give you an example, at some point we realized that India does not have many good tournaments happening. So there were people who wanted to go to Europe to play, and they couldn't afford it. So we started something called ChessBase India Power, where one person would travel with like 10 kids and go to an event, go to like for 2 months in Europe and help these kids maybe get their norms or, you know, play in these strong tournaments. So it was all about understanding what was the need there. At some point, we were also managing some players' Facebook accounts, or back then Instagram wasn't that popular, trying to put out social media content for them. So whatever was needed at that point, we were doing. And then eventually, the YouTube channel picked up, which was completely unthought of. Like, it just started one fine day. We had like 800 subscribers, and we went to this tournament in World Cup 2017 in Tbilisi, and it was one entire month, and we started doing interviews, doing coverage on ground. And I remember there was this one video where Magnus Carlsen was beaten by Bo Xiangzi back then, and it got to like 500k in like a few days, and we realized, oh my god, like, here there's some potential to make revenue, to cover events and so on, which was, we never knew such opportunity existed. So that's how the YouTube channel began. We reached 5,000 subscribers at the end of that event, which was amazing.
It's interesting. You mentioned Frederick and also some of the young Indian players at the time, like Nihal and Prague. And I remember seeing Nihal and Prague when they were like very little kids. Maybe they were like 10 years old or something. They were playing in the Isle of Man. I can't remember quite which year it was. But like, one of my early memories of hearing about like the current Indian talents was Frederick. In 2019, I visited ChessBase, and of course I had heard the names of Nihal and Prague, but then he was like, you know, I just saw this this new kid, Gukesh, is playing. And that was the first time I'd heard the names. Okay, I thought, yeah, it's, you know, another talented kid, but yeah, we'll see what happens, right?
And what about your personal ambition? You're just 11 years, 6 months old. What do you want to do when you grow up?
I want to become the youngest world chess champion.
You want to become the youngest world chess champion, yeah?
Yeah.
So that was, you just brought up that memory in my mind when you mentioned Frederick and also the young Indian players.
I think Frederick has been someone who's very good at spotting talents. I mean, just players, but also he recognized that I had this knack of storytelling. So he spent a lot of time helping me improve my writing skills. So I would have like I would send an article and he would make these two columns correcting my English, which was terrible at that time. So he really laid the foundation for me becoming a better writer and so on. And whenever he spotted a young talent, like as Fabi mentioned, Gukesh, Nihal, Prag, he would instantly try to talk to them or, you know, send some softwares to them just to motivate them. And that was very cool. It would be kind of inspiring for these youngsters when he would speak with them and tell them stories about Gary or about Vishy, about Magnus, and I think Frederick spent a lot of time with all of them. So,
and maybe I'm mistaken, but he's good friends with Vishy, right? Vishy used to visit their studio in Germany. Fabi, did you ever do anything for Chessbase? Were you having, like, let's say, relationship at that time?
I mean, that time I mentioned in 2019, I was doing some video series on Rui Lopez for Chessbase. I spent about 5 days, and I think Frederick at the time was kind of retiring in that period, so he was moving away from his work in Chessbase. But we had some conversations, and that's when he mentioned Gukesh and showed me some photos of training and that sort of thing. But yeah, I do remember that he was also good friends with Vishy for a long time, and they had some close connection. But from my point of view, I only really did the one time with Chessbase film, because I'm not so much, you know, making instructional content. But I did do the one series with them.
Yeah, I liked it, actually. I had seen it entirely back then.
And I think you mentioned something very cool. The fact that you guys sort of built from the foundation up, and you were thinking already in those type of terms, like coming from your coaching experience, let's say, you understood that there needs to be a foundation, there needs to be a systematic approach to teaching this new talent that's coming out of India. And obviously, there has been a lot of grandmasters that have been called into India from foreigners sometimes, right? Obviously, the most famous example being Vladimir Kramnik, and we'll get to that in just a second. I'm sure we'll discuss that. But how did that came to be? Obviously, you guys have Ramesh as well, who is right now becoming one of the most established coaches in the world. How did that foundation take shape, the coaching foundation?
I think for me, I understood chess at a decent level, so I could cover it well. I could sort of ask the right questions when I would interview someone or write articles which were having both storytelling aspect as well as analysis. But I never really ventured into teaching any of these youngsters. I was a player till 2017 while they were also growing. So in fact, it's a pity I never got to play with them in that period, because maybe I would have been a small favorite back then. And but
not
I,
for
I
long, couldn't... not for long,
not for long, not for long. Maybe 2014 or 15, or perhaps these 2 years. But clearly, I think one of the things that has really helped Indian chess is the fact that many of the strong grandmasters took up to full-time training, which includes Ramesh, Vishnu Prasanna, Srinath Narayanan, Shyam Sundar, Swapnil Dhopade, Swayams Mishra. All these are grandmasters who reached an ELO of around 2500 to 2550. But then they said, let's get into training full time. And I think each of these young talents who have grown up have some kind of a mentor, or you can say that initial sort of rise with them. Maybe Arjun is a exception in that sense, because he worked with the Israeli coach. I forget
Gelfand, the name. Boris Gelfand.
No, it was Mikhailovsky.
Mikhailovsky.
Yeah, when he was around 2300 to 2550, he worked with them. But then he worked with Srinath, who took him to around 2550 to 2750 or so. So I feel like having someone from the same country who understands that culture and so on is very useful, because then even the parents can build some kind of a rapport with them, talk to them and so on. And I think for Gukesh, it was Vishnu. For Prag, it was Ramesh. For Nihal, it was Srinath when he was growing up and so on.
That's an interesting idea. And Fabi, maybe you can build up on this this cultural connection between coach and pupil. And you've worked with so many different type of coaches, right? Did you ever feel this connection between cultural connection, let's say, between student and coach?
Well, there's very often, when I was growing up, you know, the biggest chess school was the Russian chess school. Yeah, it's a bit mythological even. And so a lot of my coaches were from former Soviet countries. A lot of my early coaches, you know, Miron Scherer, Boris Slotnik, Alexander Chernin.
Yesterday saw a book by Miron Scherer, which wrote behind it, do you want to do the same homework that Fabi and Robert Hess used to do in their childhood? Something like that.
Yeah, no, he was a great great coach. He sadly passed away a few years ago, but he was my coach. He was also the coach of Robert Hess for a long time throughout his childhood, my childhood, and also many other players in the United States and especially in New York, in the New York area where I grew up. So I can't say that I had like the connection that you mentioned, you know, between a coach from the same country, right? Because a lot of my coaches were from former Soviet Union. So I feel like it was a bit different. But yeah, when I was growing up, it was like, you know, the mark of quality was the, let's say, the Russian chess school, right? So that was where a lot of coaching came from. And but actually, you mentioned Srinath. It's an interesting name for me, because I think we're more or less the same age, very, very close in age. And we played a long, long time ago. And then I didn't see him in chess for a while. And I saw him, of course, he's also a very strong player, I guess, around maybe 2650 peak rating.
I think 2570 or so, maybe.
2570, okay. And we played a long time in a tournament in Russia. I think it was called Young Stars Tournament. Mm. And then I saw him years later in a coaching capacity. So yeah, a lot of these names, they come, you know, circulate around the chess world, and you see them either playing or in coaching positions.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think India, there were all these trainers who used to come, like when for the youngsters was like Vladimirov and few other such trainers. And I think sooner, like in the recent times, it has been like the Indian trainers have started doing that work. And I believe it's been useful. Of course, all of these players do work with international trainers at some point, and then that's very important. Now, actually, many of them do, like Gukesh with Gajewski or Arjun with Kazim Janov or Prag with Peter Swidler and so on. But I guess that key phase of trying to find your own style and so on, I guess these trainers were able to help.
And it's funny that you mentioned the Russian chess school. Now, it's almost feels like there's a new Indian chess school being developed in terms of coaching, which is much more focused, I would say, on psychology, at least from what I'm gathering from Ramesh. And he's been coaching in Romania as well. He's been hired by the Romanian Chess Federation. He's going there and running camps. I feel a lot of his style is very much focused on building up a certain mentality for the players, especially at a young age. He's very much focused at teaching kids. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because you've been, let's say, observing him throughout his camps, his teachings.
I think what I found absolutely amazing when I interview Ramesh, and I've done videos like tips for chess trainers or tips for young chess improvers, is that he has like all these tips at the tip of his tongue. Like he can just say point wise 10 things like this, you know, like I sometimes feel, has he come prepared for this interview or something? But Absolutely not. He just has all these things in his mind, and he's so fluent with this. And I've been very, very surprised. And everything he speaks makes so much sense. So I believe that he has this amazing teaching ability in him, which actually developed because he has done insane number of hours of training. Because he would wake up at 4 a.m. in the morning, train people who are in the U.S., then have his own group trainings where he had this kind of very interesting concept that players of all levels should train together. He would have like a group session and then everyone would work together. And I would sometimes think, oh, but isn't this not so great for this player who's the strongest, you know? But I believe that was not the case. And he's proved it that everyone could learn from each other. And he has been able to create players like Prag, Arvind, Karthikeyan Murli, Vaishali. I mean, the list is endless. At some point, he was training just about any grandmaster in Indian chess who was at the brink of, let's say, an IM title or something, would go to Chennai, stay with him, learn from him. That was Sethuraman, Adiban, Debashish Das. And many of them developed their own training methods after working with him. So I would definitely say he played a huge role in building this sort of training culture in India, because he went all in. He gave up his job, which was in a public sector company, and took up training full time for built Chess Gurukul. So I think he's very inspiring for chess trainers in the country.
Fabi, what's your take on this group sessions with players of different levels? Because I have my own take, but I want to hear yours first. Did you ever experience that? Did you train with players who, let's say, were 200, 300, 400 rating points below you? Or above?
Not so much. I never really did like group training unless it was, let's say, for a specific tournament, like a training camp for candidates, to give an example, right? But like when I was a kid, it was usually one-on-one coaching. The only like group settings I can think of were in my very, very young years, and like in school or something, yeah? Like there was chess club. But that was too long ago to remember. So I don't have too much experience with it, but I think it would be helpful, because the thing is, like, my opinion, I'm not a coach, of course, so I can't say that I'm an expert on this, but if you're looking at chess, like the same things that would be helpful for, let's say, someone who's 23 or 2400 could also be helpful for someone who's 26 or 2700. I don't see why, like the skills that you might, you know, practice as a 2300 wouldn't also be useful a few hundred points higher. It's not like we're talking about 1500 versus 2500. That's a massive gulf in skill that it's not quite the same as the difference, let's say, 200 or 300 points between strong players and super strong players. There, I think there's enough common ground that you'll find something that's useful for everyone. And also, like, when I'm kind of analyzing casually with someone who, let's say, is 2400, which has happened on a number of occasions, I do find it like mutually beneficial. Also, the openings that could be useful for them or for me can be useful the other way around too. So I see no reason why a group training camp couldn't incorporate players of many levels without it with it being helpful for everyone. Maybe not equally helpful, but still helpful. You know, you can't have completely equal conditions, but definitely everyone should take some benefit from it.
Yeah, for me, when I've had this type of situation happen, I often find that sometimes the timing is a little bit difficult to deal with, because some players solve things much faster than the others, and then it's very difficult to schedule, let's say, the class and time it very well. And at some point, if you wait for too long for some of the weaker players to solve correctly, because you don't want to move too fast through the problems, through the examples, then nobody's going to get anything out of them. But if you spend too much time on that, then the players of a higher caliber get somewhat bored, and then they start asking. And this could be a very much a mentality thing, right? Also, could be a cultural thing as well, perhaps, that applies very much to India, this type of culture. I feel there's a culture of respect that applies in this dynamic of student coaching. Like, you're not going to be telling your coach, hey, let's speed things up. Why are we spending so much time on this particular problem? Why is this particular person not solving faster? But in other cultures, I feel like that's accepted, especially in the Western culture. I feel like that's something that could come up in training. What do you think of that, Sagar?
I think it could be very interesting at some point to discuss this with Ramesh, because I think he kind of has mastered this in a way where, you know, the lower rated players get inspired by the higher rated players, and the higher rated players are having their kind of fun in the session. So somehow maybe it's more like an inspiration for someone to see, oh, this is where I have to reach, and kind of then, so maybe I'm not very clear on the methods being utilized there inside the class, but I've heard from many, many players who said, oh, I got inspired by this player, and I got inspired by the one who was higher rated than me, and so on.
And now, getting back to ChessBase India, when did you feel like ChessBase India finally has developed into something that would make a larger impact? That, because you discussed the idea of taking care of players, up-and-coming players' social media, which is, I would say, quite novel. I don't think anybody else is doing it. I feel like not a lot of people are taking that seriously. And you've already spotted this many years ago, which was quite revolutionary at the time. But when did you feel like ChessBase India finally has a mission that can be accomplished and that can be used to help other players through attracting sponsors, through building up player personas? Like, when did you feel that time finally arrived?
I think the way in which we utilize social media right from the start, Facebook, I realized that there were people who were interested to read what was going on in the world of chess. So that feeling of doing something for the chess community was always there right from the beginning. It just the measure in which or how many people were being impacted depended on which tools we were using. So there was never this thing like, oh, right now, maybe we still need to reach here or so on. There was a phase where I didn't know if we could sustain or survive financially because we were a team of three people, Amruta, myself, and one more author. And we just didn't know how to pay salaries. We didn't know whether we should take some money for ourselves or continue our coaching. We also wanted to travel and play and cover events. So all of these were very open questions at that point. But when YouTube started to earn the revenue that was there, I just felt like, okay, here is something that I like to do. I can do it a lot, and that could really help. So I would say that we have like our sort of two ways of revenue making in ChessBase India. One is the e-commerce business. The other is the media, which is the YouTube thing or social media. And I think when that picked up, we really could expand our team. And when pandemic struck and chess became bigger, not just in India, but across the world, is when we kind of scaled up quite rapidly at that phase.
How many people do you have working for you
right now? Now we have 30 people whom we pay a salary.
There's very often so many journalists from ChessBase India with like two phones, a couple of cameras, tripods and whatnot. Now one of my students very often is working for you as well, Harshit Raja, who is studying at my university. So you guys have been building up this complete ecosystem. You've created jobs more or less.
I wouldn't count Harshit as an employee. We worked with him. So there are many such people with whom we have worked, but there are 30 people whom we pay a monthly salary. So in that sense...
That's a lot. That's a huge company already.
That helps because we are also based in India. And I believe that if we were, let's say, in the US or in Europe, perhaps we have not reached that stage of revenue making or profitability to have so many people. But in India, we are able to sort of work with more people. We also have sometimes many, many young talents who are still in colleges and want to gain experience, who love chess and so on. So it's a little bit kind of a company still, which is run through passion more than you can say a very, very standard business, like, oh, this is what the is a standard pay or so on. I don't think we have reached here. It's more like everyone has flexible work timings, anyone can work at any point they like, everyone's sort of passionate about chess, and this is what we've tried to build, like a group of people who feel excited about what they are doing and not so much like, okay, this is the number of hours, this is what I'm going to earn, and so on.
I was interested in one thing, because you've done many, many interviews after a game, after a tournament. Probably you've conducted even thousands of them at this point. And we've also done some after games. And I was curious to know what you felt was the most memorable, personally memorable, or just because of the content of the interview that you conducted.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. I think few interviews stand out in a big way, where I think I went to Vishy's home and interviewed him for the match that you played with Magnus. It was the last day of the classical bit, and we were traveling for 1 year. We had this nomadic life, Amruta and me, and it was the last day, and we ended it with Vishy's home, and he spoke about the match like, just it was a kind of different Vishy, just free flowing, giving his insights about everything. And that I really enjoyed that one. That was very memorable. I think the one which I did with Magnus, where after his victory at World Rapid and Blitz, he did not have time. I think he wanted to leave. But then his father mentioned, okay, while walking out, you can do it. This was in Moscow, actually. It was 2019. And we walked down from the elevator and this. And then outside in the snow, which was like maybe -5 or something, that was very unique. And I think recently, maybe the one with Gukesh after he became the world champion recently, where he spent like, I mean, when we began, I thought we would do it in an hour, but I realized that there was so much that he wanted to share and so on. It went on for 2 hours, 53 minutes. I think it's also pretty good interview there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've recently done an interview with Kramnik at the Olympiad also. And that kind of shocked me, because obviously there was some tension throughout the Olympiad between Team Uzbekistan, who was a fighter for medals, and you guys. But in the end, it felt like, let's say, we can call it somewhat of a beef has been squashed in the interview. What is your relationship with Kramnik, and what did you take away from that interview?
I think Vladimir Kramnik is someone who I greatly respect because of the camp that he did in 2019 and 2020 with the youngsters of Indian chess. The 2019 one, where we were in France. It was actually on the border of France and Switzerland. Chênes-sur-Léman was the name of the place. We rented a building. It was sponsored by Microsense, a company in India. And Amruta and I were like the caretakers, or you can say we planned to cover the event. like what was happening there, but also take care of the kids, because like Prag was 14 years old, Gukesh was 13 years old. There was Raunak, Sadwani, Prithu Gupta, Inyan, and I mean, all these young kids. And at that point, Kramnik would sort of come in around, let's say, 10 or 11 a.m. and spend the entire day there till 6 p.m., spending it with them, showing his games, talking to them, sort of building this confidence. I think it was the first time that they got to interact with a world champion closely. And I could sense them understanding because they were all like asking so many questions to him. But Kramnik would never sort of dismiss those questions. He would engage in the analysis with each one. And I think at that point, they started understanding like, oh, this is how a world champion actually thinks. So it really helped them, I think. And also, whenever they would come to him by saying, oh, we are weak at this and weak at so this phase of the game and so on, Kramnik would never like tell them, oh, this is how you improve. He would always wait and say, let's see your games. Let's see. Because he also understood that maybe the kids were diagnosing the wrong problems for themselves. And there's no point in trying to fix that, but actually identifying what are the right issues. So that camp, which happened there, and then the camp in Chennai, which was again done by Microsense, where Gelfand also became a part. And there the number of kids increased. Arjun also joined in that camp in Chennai. And then the girls, Vaishali, I think Rakshita Ravi was there. So that camp had 12 kids and they had booked like close to the place where the Olympiad was held in 2022 is where the two sort of an entire complex was booked with some rooms and a pool and a training area. And this was done for 10 days. And I have like immense gratitude to both Kramnik and Gelfand for like the time they gave and the amount of sort of they did it with their heart. They did not just come in there and say, okay, this is our job. And then they would speak to the media telling that, you know, these are the future of chess and so on. And I think that really helped these youngsters. And within a year or within a few months, then Vishy Anand started with the Westbridge Anand Chess Academy, which then sort of took that engagement to the next level because it was more continuous in nature and not just camps. So for me, like this is the image that I had of Kramnik and we've always been in very good terms there. And then when this happened in the Olympiad, my thought was more flowing from that. This is something that Kramnik as the trainer did for his team rather than anything against the Indians or the youngsters or Chess Base India or myself. And which is why I could just put forth my point of view that, yes, we've taken all the permissions from FIDE to record a game for more than 6 hours. It's very difficult to do it with a camera. I've tried to find many, many options. You need a plug point and it's very difficult for the organizers to provide it. So the phones which are checked fully, you reduce the brightness, they can last longer, have more battery life. So we can record these games and that's the logic behind it. And so I put forth those points. And then eventually when the tournament ended, I asked him that, can we speak about it? And he was more than happy. We also, I think when I came and approached him with a camera in my hand, which was my phone, he said, oh, is this checked with something? He joked about it. So, you know, it's all good.
Yeah, it felt like perhaps he was just protecting his team at that point, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this is something that Fabi mentioned in a previous podcast episode that we've done. It's the style, that the very distinct style that you guys have with Chess Base India, Tanya as well, a very passionate style. How would you describe that? And would you say this type of style helped you build the audience that you have right now?
Yeah, I think the love
very
for
personable
chess is the first.
Style.
Yeah, the personal touch. I always feel also when we commentate, I feel like engaging with the chat a lot more than just talking. And I have always found this whenever there is this delay and we are not able to delay the entire stream, but like I'm 15 minutes ahead and then the broadcast goes 15 minutes later, to be so difficult to do because I cannot interact with the live chat. But yeah, this has been my approach, that I want to build a community here. And this flowed a lot from what I learned from Samai, who is the stand-up comedian who came into chess during the pandemic. And at some point, he started doing streams where people would contribute towards causes, give super chats and everything. And I was like, how are people so giving? Like, he's just streaming here, talking about games. And, you know, like sometimes $500 super chat or $1,000. And, you know, this
did
is
he
red
have
mark.
Any connection with chess beforehand? Because he kind of popped out of nowhere and then he became this like pretty big figure in chess streaming, more or less.
Yeah, he just loved chess. Like when he was young, he played some tournaments in his school. And then during the pandemic, he tried this game called PUBG. Which is like this video game where you shoot people and so on. And he said, this is not to my liking. I need something much slower. I need to talk with my audience. And chess, somehow he remembered, okay, there was a phase in my life where I played chess. Let me try streaming it. And there's this famous dialogue that he did when he started. He says, Chaliski watching good for chess, which means watching of 40 people, good for chess. You know, it started with that. And that has stuck now with the recent World Championship, where we had 205,000 concurrent viewers from 40. So it's huge. So from him, I learned this thing of how to build community, how to involve everyone. So when he streamed, he had like a huge audience, but he would not stop at that. He would be like, oh, Sagar, why don't you join in? Or Adiban, why don't you stream? Anish, Rajabov was there, Tanya. And we built such a vibrant community back then. And then everyone was so hooked on to from this stream to that stream, and everyone would keep moving. And I realized that this guy could actually build a streaming ecosystem just by teaching people OBS or just teaching stuff, telling them of that you need good thumbnails. You know, I just had no clue that you need thumbnails. I mean, now it looks like a no-brainer. But in 2020, when the pandemic struck, I was like putting out videos and just auto thumbnails that the YouTube would generate. Like this, Samai said, and he used to pay like an amount in India. It was like around $5 or $6. And I was like, no way, this is impossible. You know, how can we afford it? And he was like, don't worry, the super chats will come and so on. And so he had this abundant mindset. And this actually started happening. We got so many super chats and so on. We built this Help Chess Foundation, where in every stream, people started to contribute towards it. We are supporting like more than 25, 30 young players now because of that money, which comes. I mean, I don't even know like one particular individual who gives. It's just like the entire community is contributing. So this, I feel amazed that this community building is feasible here. And I think without Samai, I wouldn't have learned it.
Yeah. It's quite crazy to watch the amount of support you guys are getting every single stream, and it's only getting bigger and bigger. And obviously, it more or less culminated with the World Championship match. 200k is absolutely insane. I've never thought that I would see 200k. I remember, you know, 2018, the match had a lot of viewers, but I think we hit something like 60, 70k max, and that was a lot at that time. To triple that in only like 6 years or so, that's not bad at all. So obviously there's a lot of support. Now I feel like a big part of your success also came, and I think you mentioned this at sometimes in the beginning of the podcast, you had a stream of videos that came during a big event, but I felt like a lot of your success came from some of these Rapid and Blitz World Championships, because you guys were some of the first ones to put, just simply put a camera on the board. That's it. Not much more. And just put it on YouTube. And people immediately connected with that, connected with the dynamic blitz play. Obviously, that's a big one. Would you say, in terms of content and content strategy, that rapid and blitz have a higher impact than classical right now?
So I can say that I was actually inspired to do this unknowingly, I would say, from when I was in 2014 in Spain playing my tournaments. One of my favorite things to do was to go to YouTube and look at a game played by a top player. Maybe it was Magnus. He was playing at this Dubai World Rapid and Blitz in 2014. And these were all shot by chess.com back then. They have these videos there. And I remember there were games that were played and there was nothing. Like, I would just sit and watch. And as a professional player back then who was playing tournaments, or not professional, but as a tournament player, I would look at the opening, body language and so on. And I think that made a deep impression on me. And the tournament, which was like a breakthrough event for us, was the Tata Steel Chess India 2018, where Vishy played with Prag played with Nakamura, Nihal played with Vishy. And these were all the videos which people just wanted to see. Slowly, this evolved into me commentating on these videos. Still, there are videos. I mean, earlier, to put a chess board with moves was like, oh my God, do you put so much effort to record the board, a 2D board for every game, which is now again become a no-brainer.
It's that, the standard.
You know, you need to service the viewers, and this should exist. But now maybe the commentary also is important with new people coming in. And now we've reached that stage where we record classical games and cut it down into smaller chunk, like 10 or 15 minutes. And that requires a lot of coordination, effort, but I find it worth it. For example, Gukesh's final game has 1.5 million views already in last 1 week, because it's just maybe a unique piece of content there, where the entire game with the expressions of the players and everything and with the commentary can be seen.
Yeah, you just said the chess content is evolving. What do you think it's next? Like, how do you think this one is going to evolve? What do we need to do? Give us some tips.
Well, I think one of the things that you guys have done brilliantly is position yourself as a podcast very well. Because I believe, like, personally, I've done many interviews which are long enough to become podcasts and so on. But the way in which you said, okay, this is a podcast, C Squared podcast, which is something missing in the chess world. So I believe you guys have actually, just the positioning is perfect. And I think then rest, of course, you Christian are interested, inquisitive, Fabi being world-class player, I think has all the ingredients of just growing all the time. So I don't think I need to say anything here. But one of the things which I feel is important is to constantly keep on trying new things, not to sort of see this has worked and to stick to it, which... Again, this time we did it at this world championship where I was very, very uncertain about this idea of doing it in a club where there were 100 to 150 live audience. And I was like, no, you know, it worked in Olympiad. I was there in Budapest. We had a room there. We streamed from there. Maybe in Singapore, it's the same. We should do it. But sort of Samay came up with this idea that we need a live audience which has the energy there. You know, they will cheer, they will do like things and people will get excited back home, the thousands of people who are watching. And I didn't get it. But when I just thought, let's try it. You know, just being open there helped a lot, because people then later told us, like, it was so much fun when everyone would erupt. And similar, then I found the analogy that in comedy series where there are these laughters, fake laughters that play when a joke is cracked, and you feel a bit funny, you know, that at that point. And perhaps that is the analogy here. You feel the energy. So my general thing about content is to sort of keep trying new things, and that some will not work, some will work, but it's very useful not to get stuck in one thing, because now with the amount of chess content that is out there, the shelf life of each piece of content is very low. This is something that I have seen literally on the analytics. There were videos that I had created in 2018, which used to like be relevant for 3 to 4 years. But now any piece of content is like relevant for a few days, like 3 days, four days. And
I've noticed that as well. I've noticed that as well.
This makes it difficult to invest for rights, to pay for it, because you are like, will this survive? Will this give back? Earlier, it was much better, but this is a challenge that we have to take up for ourselves.
Fabi, any final questions?
Yeah, I think I'm also curious about future plans, tournaments that you are most interested in covering or visiting, or you know, people that you're most interested in following, these kinds of things. I'm interested in what your future interests with Chess Space India are.
One of the things that I want to do is maybe go to more events, which, like, for example, right now I'm going to New York in 2 days, and then to Waikanae, where
I'll see you in both places.
Yes, in both you're playing, and then again at Weisenhaus, I think you will be there as well.
Three places,
And so this kind of journey where I want to travel more and continue building up content at the place of the venue and so on, which is generally not so easy to do, because I think most of the times you have an entire setup at home and so on. So this is something that I truly enjoy doing. So I want to travel to these events, and also to remain very open to various possibilities, because 2024 turned into an unbelievable year of chess for India. With Gukesh winning both the candidates and world championship, India winning the Olympiad, and I could not have ever imagined what would that bring. And right now I can see the excitement that there are more people coming forward and saying, hey, can we do something in chess? Can we build something in chess? Big brands who want to, who see the interest. And I feel at this point, it shouldn't be about what the plans I have, but rather how I can enable these new people to come into the ecosystem and get settled in so that chess grows. And I think that I see as my main role, to grow the ecosystem, to invite new people to come in and not just say, oh, this is my domain, or this is the domain for a few players out there, but to make it grow as much as it is possible.
Sagar, awesome. Awesome story. And I think you have an incredible trajectory in the world of chess, and you've carved a very special place for yourself, but also for your community. Now, to finish it off, I just want to do a fun rapid fire round. Okay. So I have a couple of questions ready, and you just have to answer really quick and get it over with. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Favorite chess tournament ever covered?
Tata Steel Chess India 2018.
Chess player who inspires you the most?
Vishy Anand, for his humility.
Dream interview guest for Chess Base India?
I don't know. I think one of these 4-year-old kids, let's say Anish Sarkar or someone, with perhaps a top player in the world like Magnus or Fabi, you know, doing something with them would be really amazing.
Best piece of career advice you've received?
I really love this book. I don't know. I was just lying here. And I think one of the things that it talks about is to be in the present moment always. And I think that's the most important.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Very funny. That's the second time today I've seen that book. Like really? Completely randomly somewhere else. A friend put like a story of books that were read in a year. And that was one of the books. So that was very, very random that was a book lying on your table. But that's quite interesting.
I guess maybe it's just a thing that maybe you can get this book. But
Christmas is coming.
I will bring it to the US. But I interviewed Paddy Upton, who was the mind trainer for Gukesh, and he also recommended this book. So it's quite the book.
Cool. Awesome.
And just to end this, I want to thank both of you for inviting me. And also, Fabi, I really feel the ability of yours to be sort of objective in any situation and give your opinion is something which is very unique. I don't think there are too many people who can do that, not taking things very personally, but just looking at an issue from all sides. I always enjoy that when I look at the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for
coming on.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you Sagar for joining us, and we'll see you in New York.
See you, Christian. See you, Fabi. Bye.
Cheers, guys. Bye.